You are listening to KLRN Radio, where liberty and reason still reign.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star.
This fall, Inspiration 4 launches as the first all-civilian mission to space. And you could be on board.
Up above the world, so
visit inspiration4.com for your chance to go to space.
Dealing with COVID-19 is uncharted territory, and everyone has different challenges. People may feel anxious, down, or overwhelmed. For some, these feelings can lead to changes in sleep patterns, an increased use of alcohol or drugs, or withdrawing from the people around them. If you know someone who's having a hard time coping, you can help by reaching out to talk and listen. To learn more about how you can help someone in need, call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-TALK.
Some people look to the stars and ask, what if? Our job is to have an answer. We have to imagine what will be imagined. Plan for what's possible while it's still impossible. Maybe you weren't put here just to ask the questions. Maybe you were put here to be the answer. Maybe your purpose on this planet isn't on this planet.
KLRN Radio has advertising rates available. We have rates to fit almost any budget. Contact us at advertising@klrnradio.com.
Time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger.
The following program may contain coarse language, adult themes, and bad attempts at humor. Listener discretion is advised.
What is President Trump's goal? What is his vision? He wants to put an American flag on Mars.
Now I can say in less than a day we'll be underway on a mission to Mars. Theoretical themes, radical schemes, chasing our dreams on a mission to Mars.
Welcome to The Lost Wanderer for the fourth day of December of the year 2022. I am your host, J.E. Double F. Tonight, we will be talking Artemis, aging out, astronomer Karen's assholes in space, and probably a few more things. First, though, let's go to the top story for the night. Good evening. It has been a while since I've done an episode of The Lost Wanderer, and honestly, was not even sure this episode would happen. I did not even promote this show, so I could just kind of get back into the feel of doing this. So we'll see how it goes. When we left off from the last episode, a long, long, long time ago, on August 28th, if memory serves correctly, Artemis was just about to launch, and then it didn't, and we waited, and waited, and waited again for it to launch. Like the last episode, we are going to start off with the Artemis talk. With a mighty roar, the most powerful NASA rocket ever built, the Space Launch System, it soared into the Florida early morning sky on the Artemis 1 mission, a very long-delayed test flight to send a next-generation space capsule to the moon and back. Liftoff finally occurred November 16th at 1:47 a.m., which really sucks for people who wanted to watch it, from NASA's Pad 39B at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Liftoff of Artemis 1, NASA commentator Darrell Nail said during the webcast of the morning's launch, "We rise together, back to the moon and beyond." A few minutes later, Artemis launch director Charlie Blackwell Thompson addressed her team at Mission Control, quote, "This is your moment. We are all part of something incredibly special, the first launch of Artemis, the first step in returning our country to the moon and eventually to Mars. What you have done today will inspire generations to come." Okay. As in previous attempts, this morning's try saw a fair share of setbacks. While the SLS upper stage fueling process was underway, roughly 3 hours prior to the launch, an intermittent leak was detected in the liquid hydrogen replenishment valve on Artemis 1's mobile launch tower. NASA sent a specialized red crew to the tower to tighten packing nuts to stop the leak, a process that took roughly an hour. Gotta say, can I get a red crew to tighten my nuts that lasts an hour? Just asking. Me, no. Following that fix, a separate issue with an Ethernet switch at the radar site on the U.S. Space Force Eastern Range caused further uncertainty, prompting a no-go on the range until a replacement was found. The Ethernet issue was fixed while the launch countdown was at the planned T10-minute hold. With all the issues finally resolved, the rocket cleared the launch pad, sending powerful shockwaves to the ground and air that reminded onlookers of the uniqueness of the moment. Now, that was the third launch attempt for Artemis 1. An initial attempt on August 29th was scrubbed due to a glitch in the cooling process. That one of the rocket's four main engines experienced. A second attempt on September 3rd was also scrubbed when a hydrogen leak was detected during the rocket's lengthy fueling process. SLS was slowly rolled back to KSC's vehicle assembly building for repairs and to shelter it from Hurricane Ian, which slammed into Florida's Space Coast in late September. More recently, the amended target date of November 12th was delayed because of another hurricane, this one being Nicole, which oddly was quickly downgraded to a tropical storm following landfall. High winds, though, produced by the storm tore a piece of insulative caulking away from the outside of the Orion spacecraft, prompting Artemis mission teams to study the issue and determine if a November 16th launch was within their safety parameters. But 8 minutes after liftoff, the SLS's upper stage reached orbit with Orion, with the spacecraft starting to unfurl its four solar arrays from its service module shortly thereafter. A spacesuited clad Snoopy plush toy was aboard to float around in weightlessness along with Sean the Sheepdog from NASA's Orion partner, the European Space Agency, which provided the service module. Artemis 1, the first mission of the Artemis program, is sending an uncrewed Orion capsule on a nearly 26-day journey to lunar orbit and back. Orion is scheduled to slip into distant retrograde orbit around Earth's natural satellite. The capsule will spend about a week there and then head back toward Earth, arriving here, back on terra firma, sorta, in an ocean splashdown on December 11th. Now, if all goes according to plan, Artemis 2 will launch astronauts around the moon in 2024, and Artemis 3 will put boots down near the lunar South Pole a year or so later. And we do have some other recent news out of NASA. Bob Behnken is retiring from NASA after a pioneering 22-year career. Bob spent a total of 93 days in space over the course of three separate missions. Most of his off-Earth time came on Demo 2, SpaceX's first ever crewed flight, which sent Behnken and fellow NASA astronaut Doug Hurley to the ISS for 2 months in the summer of 2020. His last day at the agency was November 11th, NASA officials announced. Quote, "Bob Behnken is a distinguished and talented astronaut and an effective ambassador for our never-ending mission to explore the cosmos," said NASA Administrator Bill Nelson in a statement released on November 10th. Quote, Bob and fellow NASA astronaut Doug Hurley launched into history with their impeccable command of NASA and SpaceX's Demo 2 mission and played a pivotal role in helping a new era of commercial space take flight, Nelson added. Along with the entire NASA family, I appreciate Bob's service to our country and wish him well, all the best in his next endeavor, Nelson concluded. Finken joined NASA as an astronaut candidate in July of 2000. He first left Earth in 2008, serving as a mission specialist on the STS-123 flight of the Space Shuttle Endeavour, which delivered Japan's Kibo Laboratory and Canada's Dextra robotic arm to the ISS. He performed three spacewalks during the nearly 16-day mission. And then Finken flew to the orbiting lab again in 2010 on Endeavour's two-week-long STS-130 mission. That flight also brought key hardware to the ISS, the Tranquility Module and the seven-window cupola, which affords astronauts stunning views of their home planet. He performed three spacewalks during the 2010 flight and four more over the course of Demo 2, racking up a total of 10 extravehicular activities overall. Now, it should be noted, Finken is also a former U.S. Air Force colonel who accrued more than 2,000 flight hours and more than 25 different types of aircraft, according to the NASA statement. He did retire from military service in February of this year. In a statement, Finken said, I am humbled to have had the opportunity to represent our nation as a NASA astronaut and thankful to have been part of the team that returned home our human spaceflight to the United States back in 2020. I am so looking forward to seeing and being amazed by what people of this great agency will accomplish next. From the Lost Wonder and our family, we'd like to wish Bob a happy retirement. Now, NASA is known for making, well, honestly, many brave moves. But I think there's one move recently that kind of flew under the radar for just how shockingly brave it was. NASA has officially declared they will not rename the James Webb Space Telescope. The James Webb Space Telescope launched in December of 2021 amid calls for the observatory to be renamed. The observatory was named in 2002 after government bureaucrat James Webb, who served as the second administrator of NASA during the 60s. Opponents of the name argue that Webb persecuted people known or suspecting to belong to the LGBTQ whatever other letters community. Now, NASA has concluded an investigation into Webb's role in what's been dubbed the Lavender Scare, and the agency has decided to leave his name on the $10 billion telescope. No mention on the cost of, you know, flying out to where the telescope is and having someone scrub the name from the... Anyway, quote, to date, no available evidence directly links Webb to any actions or follow-ups related to the firing of individuals for their sexual orientation, the report reads. Based on the available evidence, the agency does not plan to change the name of the James Webb Space Telescope. As early as spring of 2021, astronomers were raising concerns about Webb's record. By September, a petition calling for a new name of the observatory was gathering signatures. At the end of September, current NASA Administrator Bill Nelson said the agency would not change the name. In March of this year, with the telescope safely in orbit, documents about the investigation obtained through Freedom of Information policies and released by the journal Nature, shocker, reinvigorated the debate. In April, NASA officials said their investigations into Webb's record were continuing. Since then, attention has focused on the science the observatory is already conducting. In a statement released Friday, November 18th, NASA officials exonerated Webb while condemning broader federal government actions in the 1950s during the Lavender Scare, and a nod to the intertwined but better remembered Red Scare, which was more real than the Lavender Scare. The Lavender Scare included a surge in discrimination, allegedly, against the persecution of government employees who were suspected of being what one 1950 document cited in the report calling homosexuals and other moral perverts. NASA did not comment on the sitting current president. Oh, wait a minute, I may have added that one. But honestly, overall, good on NASA for this move. A, the telescope's already out in orbit. Fuck nature and everyone else complaining about it. I get it. If you were part of the people who may have been terminated or mistreated, I get it. I do. You do have my sympathy for that. But 1950s and 60s people, come on. But with that, let's transition to SpaceX news. Crew resupply mission 26. The mission to resupply the ISS was successfully launched on November 26th at 2:20 p.m. Eastern. As is my wont, and honestly, I really do love talking about these resupply missions, let's start with the food. Though a couple of days after American Thanksgiving, some of the food that was sent along included an array of holiday foods. Along with your traditional Turkey Day food, ice cream was sent, spicy green beans, stuffing, for some reason candy corn. I don't, who up on there wanted candy corn? Seriously. But can you imagine? Can you imagine enjoying a nice holiday meal and that nice little cupola that Bob Behnken was part of sending up to the ISS and just overlooking the Earth as you enjoy Thanksgiving? I mean, that would be amazing. But the mission itself, overall, delivered about 7,700 pounds of supplies and scientific experiments, including projects designed by students and sponsored by the ISS National Laboratory's educational outreach programs created to help spur interest in space sciences. Via the Student Space Flight Experiments program, middle school and high school students competed for the chance to deliver their projects to the ISS, which included interesting experiments involved with crystal growth, plant biology, physics, and microbial research. Also along for the ride will be payloads originating from the Girl Scouts of America and Space Kids Global that will investigate brine shrimp, ants, and cellular plant growth in low Earth orbit. These students' payloads will join a multitude of experiments designed by companies, universities, and research institutes, some of which will use the space environment to try to make biomedical advances. One particular project will test a new bone adhesive that could help repair fractures, for example, while another will give a new implantable drug delivery device in off-Earth trial. Additionally, Dragon will haul up on CRS-26 another set of International Space Station rollout solar arrays, which will be installed on the orbiting lab to augment its power system. Dragon will stay docked to the ISS for about 45 days, 15 days longer than a typical SpaceX cargo flight. The longer stay was implemented in order to have time to do the EVAs for the solar array install and keep our science requirements that are critical to the ISS. Let's stay with SpaceX and do a little more SpaceX news. SpaceX just got permission to begin building out the next generation of its Starlink Internet mega constellation. On Thursday, December 1st, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, approved SpaceX to deploy 7,500 Starlink 2.0 satellites in low Earth orbit. Quote, "Our action will allow SpaceX to begin deployment of Generation 2 Starlinks, which will bring next-generation satellite broadband to Americans nationwide, including those living and working in areas traditionally unserved and underserved by terrestrial systems, FCC officials wrote in the decision order. Continuing, our action also will enable worldwide satellite broadband service, helping to close the, quote, digital divide on a global scale, unquote. The ruling is really just a partial victory for SpaceX, however. The company had applied for permission to deploy, and this is a wonderful number, 29,988. Come on, you couldn't have launched 12 more, maybe even 11 just to do 29,999. But anyway, 29,988 Starlink 2.0 satellites around Earth. The FCC is currently deferring that decision about the rest of the envisioned spacecraft. The FCC granted just the limited approval, quote, to address concerns about orbital debris and space safety, unquote. These and other issues were raised by alleged interested parties regarding the 2.0 application, which SpaceX actually filed back in 2020. Quote, we also adopt requirements that require SpaceX to report mitigation actions taken to avoid any and all collisions in space, coordinate and collaborate with NASA to ensure continued availability of launch windows and on other matters, and pause deployment of new satellites if satellite failures exceed a certain threshold, the document also stated. Now, those aren't the only concerns people have raised about Starlink. Astronomers fret about the mega constellation's impact on their work, for example, and some dark sky advocates worry that it's fundamentally changing our view of the heavens. Literally, every article, whether it's about a launch of Starlink's or just talking about their approval, I swear they have to mention the bitchy astronomers. No, I get it. It interferes with their work. And some of the pictures I've seen from the telescopes, yes, I get it. I get it. But every article, come on. But if you think only Starlink is getting the wrath of astronomers, well, good news, everybody. The recent launch of Blue Walker 3, a prototype for a satellite constellation, raises the prospect of bright satellites contaminating the night skies. At 64 square meters, it is the largest commercial communication satellite in low Earth orbit, and apparently very, very bright. While Starlink is the largest satellite constellation in service with thousands of satellites in orbit, others are actually planned. Amazon's Blue Origin plans to launch more than 3,200 Project Kuiper satellites, and AST SpaceMobile plans to launch 100 Bluebird satellites, and perhaps even more. The recently launched Bluebird prototype, Blue Walker 3, has produced genuine alarm among astronomers. While Blue Walker 3 was initially kind of faint, it unfolded a 64 square meter communications array, roughly the size of a squash court. The vast surface is very good at reflecting sunlight, and Blue Walker 3 is now as bright as some of the brightest stars in the night sky. And what the hell? As big as a squash? How many people have ever been on a squash court and know what the size of it? That is what they use to demonstrate how big the array is? A squash court? Really? Let's they need to translate it into animal size, don't they? That's what we're used to. Anyway, the International Astronomical Union of Cairns has communicated its alarm about the satellite constellations and Blue Walker 3 in particular. However, the approval of satellite constellations by the U.S. Federal Communications Commission has had relatively little consideration alleged of the environmental impacts. Though this has been recently flagged as a major problem by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, but whether it leads to any concrete change at this point is unclear. With that, let's take a break for a few minutes, go grab a refill, maybe a snack, and when we come back, a certain country we love to talk about has been very, very busy. Maybe talk about space-based solar power, and I'm sure there'll be more subjects. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. Oh boy, we made it through the first half. Can you believe it? It feels, honestly, it feels a little weird to be back. Now, between Artemis's constant delays to launch bullying, honestly, it spoiled my space mood. Along with the passing of KLRN's number one fan, Ron, really, I'm being brutally forthright, made piecing this show together more difficult than I honestly imagined. He would send me stories routinely, talk about the show, and you know, give me compliments, which I really did appreciate. So since the last episode of Lost Wonder, I have actually kept up my routine of gathering the news and organizing it. And then when I didn't do a show, I'd move that into an old file and continue staying up on the news with the hopes that someday, relatively soon, I would actually do another episode and get back into doing this. So I apologize that it has been a while since the last show, but hopefully going forward, there will definitely become a routine again. But there was one segment in particular that Ron just, you know, he really liked. And I know a lot of you do too. So that is where we're going to go to start the second half.
And now, Assholes in Space!
China is asshole! China is asshole! China is asshole! China is asshole!
China has, they've been busy little beavers lately. And mind you, the stories I'm going to cover tonight are really in the range of 2 to 4 weeks. The problem with China is some of their events are done a month and a half ago, but we sometimes don't get more detail until, you know, 2 weeks, 1 week ago. So usually, and this is for even when I'm doing the every other week episodes of Lost Wanderer, these China stories can usually have a 2 to 4 week window. China has completed a first hot fire test of a fully assembled, powerful new engine that could power new launch vehicles and boost the country's space capabilities. The fuel system test of the 500-ton thrust, dual-nozzle, kerosene-liquid oxygen staged combustion cycle engine took place on November 5th, marking a milestone or that particular rocket engine. The engine, sometimes referred to as the YF-130, is more than 4 times more powerful than the nation's current YF-100 kerosene liquid oxygen engines, which produce 120 tons of thrust and are used in China's Long March 5, 6, and 7 rockets. The first hot fire test of the full systems 130 marks a major milestone, the CASC said in a statement. The engine is being developed by the 6th Institute of the China Aerospace Science and Technologies Corporation, or CASC, a giant state-owned enterprise and the country's main space contractor. The powerful new engine has been slated for use in the first stage of a Long March 9 super heavy lift rocket that could facilitate missions to the moon and even Mars. The development follows the successful testing in September of a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine for the rocket's upper stage. Despite the breakthroughs, China is, though, apparently considering revamping and altering its super heavy lift rocket plans to pursue, see if you've heard this one before, pursue reusability. New presentations of reusable Long March 9 rocket concepts by senior Chinese space officials have come in the wake of progress made by SpaceX on its reusable rockets and the huge new Starship system that they've probably already stolen all the records from, but we won't go there. If their testing of that wasn't quite interesting enough, China has completed the construction of what is now the world's largest array of telescopes dedicated to studying the sun and how its behaviors affect the Earth. The Daosheng Solar Radar Telescope, or DSRT, located on a plateau in Sichuan province of southwest China, consists of 313 dishes, each with a diameter of nearly 20 feet, forming a circle with a circumference. There we go. I can say the Chinese names. I struggle with the English. I'm back, folks. But anyway, the circumference of nearly 2 miles. DSRT is focused on observing solar flares and coronal mass ejections, which can interfere with or overload electronics and wreak havoc on and above Earth. CMEs are triggered by realignments in the star's magnetic field that occur in sunspots, and when directed at Earth, can threaten power grids, telecommunication, orbiting satellites, and even put the safety of astronauts aboard the ISS and China's Tiangong space station at risk. But you already knew this because you listened to Alan Ray on Sunday Night with Alan Ray, which, by the way, follows tonight's episode. And in addition to this, I'm going to add, perhaps they are also making sure they can hear the communications for our future overlords that will arrive by 2035. More on that on an episode of In the Crease later. But wait. You know what? There's more. China sent yet another clutch of Gaofen Earth observation satellites to space on Wednesday, November 16th. A CIRRUS-1 rocket carrying four Gaofen O3D satellites launched Wednesday at 2:20 a.m. Eastern Standard Time from the Jiquan Satellite Launch Center in northwest China. Xinhao, a state-run media outlet, confirmed that the satellites had deployed successfully. The payloads lifted by the rocket will be used to provide commercial remote sensing services and probably spying, though that addendum was added by me. Adding that this is the fourth flight of CIRRUS-1, which is built by the state-supported Beijing company Galactic Energy. The Gaofen series forms part of the Chinese high-resolution Earth observation satellites, which aims to capture high-resolution imagery of our planet's surface. But the uses of Gaofen satellites remain somewhat nebulous unless you listen to this show, where we always refer to them as spy satellites. During past launches, Chinese state media outlets have said the Gaofen satellites assist with urban planning, spying, road network design, spying, land surveys, probably spying, crop yields and disaster relief, and probably more spying. Capabilities of the Gaofen series include microwave, optical, and radar remote sensing. But the South China Morning Post has suggested there may be military applications of the satellite as well. Well, golly, you don't say. Seriously, listen to the show. You would know. Wednesday's launch was China's 53rd of 2022, bringing the country within three liftoffs of matching its 2021 record of 56. The country generally operates independently of the international space community. NASA is restricted by the United States government in making bilateral agreements with China, although NASA Administrator Bill Nelson recently said that collaboration with China is actually, quote, up to China, unquote. Now, the Chinese would never do anything nefarious with these satellites, right? I mean, sorry, you can't hear my eye roll. Anyway. But that's not the only satellite recently launched. Nope, not by a long shot. On China's 49th launch earlier, China has put a new powerful communication satellite heading into geostationary orbit after a successful launch over the weekend. A Long March 3B rocket blasted off at 7:50 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Saturday, November 5th from the Xichang Satellite Launch Center in southwest China. The Zhangjing 19 or China Sat 19 satellite will orbit a fixed spot over the Asia Pacific region, 22,236 miles above the equator. From there, it will mainly provide communication services for important travel routes across the Pacific, the Eastern Pacific Ocean, and the west coast of North America, according to CASC. Sources within the Lost Wanderer, aka me, also wonder if this is a good way for the Chinese military to attack America, but we won't continue that thought, now will we? The satellite carries K-band high throughout communications payload designed for broadband internet services and also hosts KU-band and C-band transponders. Isn't that interesting? Well, the satellite is based on a DFH-4 satellite platform. It was manufactured by the China Academy of Space Technology and will be operated by China Satcom, both subsidiaries of CASC, because everything is a subsidiary of that. The China Academy of Launch Vehicle Technology, another institute, by the way, owned by the CASC, provided the launch vehicle for the mission. And, oh, by the way, you thought maybe I was done with China? Nope. They're still going. China's fourth crew has reached the nation's newly completed Tiangong space station. A Long March 2F rocket topped with a Shenzhou 15 spacecraft lifted off the Jiquan Satellite Launch Center in the Gobi Desert at 10:08 a.m. Eastern Time. Spacecraft separation occurred some 10 minutes later. Bell Junlong, the mission commander, Ding Qingming, and Zhang Lu, who were unveiled as the Shenzhou 15 back on November 28th, arrived at Tiangong today at 4:42 p.m. Eastern. The Shenzhou 15 mission marks the start of full operations aboard Tiangong, with the trio lined up to conduct more than 100 experiments using 24 specially designed science cabinets installed in the new Wenxin and Mingxian modules. Fei, Ding, and Zhang were greeted on Tiangong by the Shenzhou 14 crew, Shen Dong, Liu Yang, and Kai Shashi, who have spent the past half year in space helping construct the space station. The three new astronauts will take control of the completed T-shaped Tiangong space station, which received its second and third modules in the recent months. Now, on November 12th, China launched the Tianzhou 5 cargo spacecraft, which delivered around 11,000 pounds of goods and materials to support the Shenzhou 15 crew for their mission. And the damn Chinese did not mention any food in any of their reports, and it pisses me off. Every cargo spacecraft has to have a story about what food they're bringing. It's fun. Anyway, the space freighter also carried 3,080 pounds of propellant to help the space station maintain its orbit. Meanwhile, the Shenzhou 14 crewmates will be preparing for their journey home after overseeing the arrival of the two new modules and conducting three spacewalks, among other activities. They are expected to touch down near the Jiquan Launch Center in early December. Date wasn't really mentioned. Shenzhou 15 is the final mission of 11 launches planned to construct Tiangong and bring it to full operation. The first saw the launch of the Tianhe core module in April 2021, just under 18 months ago. So I'm going to be honest here. I'm going to praise China for a moment. 18 months for that? No, okay. China's completed Tiangong station is only about 20% as massive as the ISS. But still, 18 months, it's kind of impressive. Now, the country aims to keep it permanently occupied for at least a decade and is looking to develop commercial and tourist missions to the orbital outpost. Okay, this time, I think I'm done with the Chi-Coms for now. So let's take a deep breath and pause for a second. Okay, there we go. How about we go from the Red Scare? Oh, no, we did the Red Scare earlier to the Red Country. How about we venture to the Red Planet for a little while? A charger rover that could supply power to robots exploring shared craters on the moon's south pole will join expanding lunar infrastructure by 2025. The world space agencies have grand plans for the exploration of the moon performed by robots and even humans alike. By the end of this decade, a space station will orbit Earth's natural satellite and a permanent base station near the moon's south pole will be built shortly thereafter, if all goes according to plan. The permanently shadowed craters in the south pole's vicinity are kind of a particular interest to scientists, as their unspoiled interiors may contain evidence of the solar system's past. But since the sun's rays never reach inside of those craters, any rovers exploring them will have to rely on limited power of their onboard batteries. But to help provide a steady source of power for the future lunar rovers, Toronto-based startup Steels Space plans to land a power supplier rover on the moon by 2025 that could beam power into the craters for the robotic scientists to actually recharge with. The Mobile Power Rover 1, or MPR-1, will charge other lunar exploration participants who install Steels lightweight wireless receiving coil or already have a third-party vendor coil. This project aims to bring moon exploration a significant step towards the ultimate goal of the long-term presence on the moon. The company plans to place the 66-pound rover to the moon's surface on board Intuitive Machines' Nova C lander by 2025. Wireless charging, the company add, would work well in the vacuum of space. To increase reliability of the space technology, the company is using components developed for Mars rovers, geostationary satellites, and deep space probes. Additionally, when it comes to on-the-ground exploration of Mars, rovers actually do make pretty good advanced scouts. From Pathfinder to Perseverance, we've kind of watched as the semi-autonomous robots do what humans explorers want to do in the future. But now engineers are studying ways to expand rover exploration on Mars. One thing that they're thinking about, communication satellite constellations for Mars surface navigation, so GPS for Mars. The current generation of Mars rovers land in an easy, accessible place. Other Martian regions, such as the poles or the Valles Marineris, remain untouched. That's partly because they're difficult to reach and their weather conditions present challenges. The poles hold a lot of clues to the Martian climate system. Although one cap is known to be mostly water ice, both caps could contain, or maybe even hiding, additional water either in underground lakes or frozen beneath the caps. And that is a commodity that any future Mars explorers will need to tap into for survival in other operations. All of these reasons make the polar regions a prime target for future rovers. Today, orbiters around Mars do the heavy lifting of communications between Earth and the Red Planet. But future exploration requires more flexible communication systems, particularly if we're going to study the polar regions. So, let's imagine this scenario. NASA, SpaceX, or another agency wants to send a fleet of rovers to Mars polar caps. Distance complicates communications from the ground to the rovers for their every move. Late travel times of many minutes can make it very hard to navigate in real-time situations. The solution is to deploy satellite constellations that can see the polar regions and help the rovers navigate more accurately. To this end, a team of engineers led by PhD student Serena Molly at the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at the Sapanzi University of Rome did a concept study of small sats constellations at Mars. Their objective is to design one that is almost completely autonomous and can handle the relative and absolute positioning of its nodes around the planet. The constellation should support navigation for other probes, such as objects in the entry, descent, and landing phase, as well as landers, rovers, or even orbiters. These nodes would communicate with each other via an inter-satellite link and with the rovers and other installations on the surface. In an upcoming paper in Acta Astronautica, Molly and the team outlined modules for two such constellations. They focus on systems that do not need constant updates from Earth. Each uses five satellites to communicate with each other and the surface. Depending on their orbital configuration, they could give nearly constant coverage of the polar regions. Sounds like, I'm not lying, sounds like maybe a perfect job for Starlink. Just saying, they already are kind of doing that now, so why not? But speaking of power and satellites, something that I have been saying for years may actually be worked on in coming to Earth relatively soon. European aerospace giant Airbus has demonstrated how solar power could be beamed from space in a new experiment. So far, the wireless transmission system has only bridged the distance of a little over 100 feet. Nothing, I know, 100 feet, that's not a lot. But engineers are confident that they can increase its range to reach all the way to space within the next decade. The demonstration, which took place at Airbus's X-Works Innovation Factory in Germany in September, saw electrical power transmitted from a photovoltaic panel in the form of microwaves to a receiver some 118 feet away. The beamed energy lit up a model city and powered a hydrogen generator and a fridge containing alcohol-free beer. Oh, come on, that the audience, it's non-alcohol or alcoholic-free beer in Germany. Ugh, that's a crime against humanity. I'm sorry. Well, anyway, apparently the audience did enjoy it. Wimps. Even though it might seem as a long way to go from 118 feet to Earth's orbit, Airbus engineers believe the first operating power beaming prototypes could be in use by the early 2030s. No mention of 2035, by the way. Anyway, Airbus will likely first attempt to beam solar power from an aerial platform before aiming for space. Ultimately, solar power harvested in space and beamed to aircraft could revolutionize aviation, the company thinks. Flying aircraft could also serve as mobile nodes transmitting the power wherever else it might be needed on Earth. This, quote, this could, in fact, be a game changer for aircraft with the potential to extend the range, reduce the weight, but also to relay power to other places, managing energy like data. Jean-Dominique Cossy, a senior manager Airbus Blue Sky Department, which develops the innovative technology, said in a statement, solar power energy generation is way, way more efficient in space than on Earth's surface, where clouds and the day-night cycle prevents achieving maximum illumination. In fact, solar radiation is 50% more intense in space, where no air stands in the way of the rays. So air is cock-blocking the sun's energy. Okay. However, the technology is not necessarily without current drawbacks. Quote, if satellites were to collect the sunlight, they would need to measure about 2 kilometers or 1.2 miles across to achieve the same power level as a nuclear power plant. And nothing of that size has ever flown into space as far as these Earthlings know. The largest space-borne structure ever assembled in orbit is currently the ISS, which is only about the size of a football field. There is no need for complex and costly ground infrastructure, power plants, pipelines, or cables to distribute the electricity on Earth, Coste said. That, too, is going to be done by power beaming. Kind of cool when you think about it. And I've been saying it for a long time. Solar sucks on Earth. All the panels, all the materials associated with it, not the smartest way to go. But the day comes that we can utilize and beam solar from outside of Earth's confines, that'll be the game changer for us. But on that note, I think we need to go grab a drink, sit by the campfire, and get ready to gaze up at the night or morning sky. December 7th. The full moon of December, known as the cold moon, arrives at 11:08 p.m. Eastern. Then, December 12th, the Surface Water and Ocean Topography, or SWOT, mission, jointly developed by NASA and the French space agency CNES, will launch on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. The launch is scheduled for 6:46 a.m. Eastern Time, so 3:46 for those actually in California, and you have my condolences already for living in California. December 13th and 14th, the annual Gemini meteor shower, one of the best meteor showers of the year, peaks overnight. Now, for a little bit of more information, the Gemini meteor shower, usually one of the most spectacular showers of the year, runs from November 19th to about December 24th. The number of meteors, which gradually ramp up to a peak during the wee hours of December 14th and then decline rapidly on the following nights. Gemini meteors are often bright, intensely colored, and slower moving than average because they are produced by sand-sized grains dropped by the asteroid designated 3200 Pantheon. In the Americas, expect to see most of the Geminis beginning after dark on Tuesday evening, December 13th, and continuing until dawn on Wednesday morning. True Geminis will appear to radiate from a position above the bright stars Castor and Pollux, but the meteors can actually appear anywhere in the sky. In years when the peak night sky is moonless, up to 120 meteors per hour are possible around 2 a.m. local time, the time when the sky overhead will be pointing toward the densest part of the debris field. In 2022, a waning gibbous moon will rise in mid-evening, obscuring the fainter meteors, but still should be an amazing view. Please get out, and if you get the chance, take a look and see what you can find. December 14th, Arion Space will launch the Galaxy 35 and 36 communication satellites for Intelsat aboard an Ariane 5 ECA rocket from Kourou, French Guiana. December 15th, a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket will launch the first two O3b M-Power broadband internet satellites into medium Earth orbit for SES of Luxembourg. The launch has been delayed from May, June, August, and November, so stay tuned to see if it gets delayed for a fifth possible time. Well, that's it for tonight's show. Thank you for tuning in when and however you do. You can find me at Stoner Brewing Co. on Twitter and catch me here on KLRN the opposite weekends, generally talking D&D on Asgard North. And pay attention to any special airings of In the Crease that come at random times. You can also find me on YouTube most every Thursday at Rancor Steve on YouTube, talking about ways basically to be a good man on Manorama. Stay tuned for KLRNradio.com for Sunday Night with Alan Ray. Special thanks to NASA, SpaceX, Space.com, New Scientist, Biz.org, and many more for great information on the stories tonight. Thanks, as always, to my executive producer for being the inspiration for the show. I hope you have enjoyed the show, learned a little bit, maybe even laughed a time or two as well.
The universe is a pretty big place. It's bigger than anything anyone has ever dreamed of before. So if it's just us, it seems like an awful waste of space. Right?
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. A miracle, oh, it was beautiful, magical. And all the birds in the trees, well, they'd be singing so happily. Oh, joyfully, oh, playfully, watching me. But then they said,